Hello and welcome to another episode of the Australian Baby Boomer podcast. Today's guest is Rosemary Stevens. Rosemary is a writer and lecturer in creative writing in both university settings and in the community. She has a long history of working in the area of creative writing, firstly for a major publishing house in London, as a travel writer, as a novelist, and in sharing her extensive knowledge base as a teacher and mentor. I asked Rosemary if she would begin by reading one of her poems.
Behind the Beat of Wings, a prose poem that I wrote a year or two ago. White cockatoos wheel over the soccer ground, distracting her from the match where her son and his teammates swarm after the ball. Clouds of birds rise, screech, and pierce her defences. She abandons the game and races for the pines, confetted with cockies ravaging cones. At swamp's edge, she finds her rock, where paper barks shed strips of skin to commune with their reflections. Granite warms her bones as she shifts out of mother mode, responsibility overload, divorce proceedings, crisis. In the pit of her belly, a snake unfurls and leads her from the rock to the disused track, whose rubble path she follows through peppermint scrub and wattle. Grass trees twist over the trail, trunks scorched from recent bushfire, the acrid smell dampened by rain. The way is potholed and littered with rocks reminiscent of limestone bones and small white pebbles that snare, slipping her back until she stumbles upon the severed trunk of a black boy, its charred abyss framed by burnished fingernails. Sunbeams flicker behind the beat of wings and black cockatoos fall from the sky.
Welcome, Rosemary, and thanks very much for agreeing to be a part of the podcast.
It's a pleasure.
Usually when we begin, we start by the interviewee saying a little bit about themselves. I'm just wondering if you could start by saying a bit about yourself and also how you became interested, if you can remember, in the world of writing and creativity.
Well, I think to begin with the last part of the question, I think I'm a compulsive writer. I suspect you might be as well. And I remember as quite a young child, just naturally turning to the page with the pen and just writing. I don't know what I wrote. But interestingly enough, I remember by the time I was about 10 or 11, actually physically producing a book. I don't remember what the little stories or the writing was about, but I remember crayoning a cover and getting cardboard and cellophane and putting the whole thing together so I had produced a book of my writing. And it's interesting how, as well as writing, I did go into publishing too.
Yes.
You know, I've been involved in producing books. So that's probably something that I do turn to if ever I'm feeling emotional or I'm, you know, there's something I need to process.
Yes.
For me, often is a combination, I think, of meditation or introspection, just sitting with the feelings. So I think there's something about that embodiment.
Yes.
And then naturally feeling an impetus to begin writing, not knowing what I'm going to write, but writing from the feeling.
Mm.
So often starting with sensations in the body or something like that. Definitely the senses seem to be really important as yes. stepping stones to get going. And then just beginning like that until a flow starts to happen. And then I'm often writing and often don't know exactly what I have written until I read it back.
Until you read it back. Do you think writing's a form of thinking, that of working out what is it actually in your mind?
Yes, I think that is very true, actually. For me it is. that I almost feel I have to do that, or else there's a sense of energy's building up in my body and in my mind, and often can feel quite emotional. Whereas once I start getting words down on a page, and the imagery is really important as part of that, and yeah, that's where the senses come in, then it's as though it can all be released, and then there's that witnessing that happens. I'm very interested in how that happens in storytelling, when there's someone telling a story, yes, and the importance of having witnesses to hold it and receive it. And I think with the writing, for me, it's that sense of reading what I've written, seeing it on the page, then that's myself, the first witness. And that's the first step in helping me to process perhaps what's going on, and as you say, understand what I think and feel.
Yes, yes. So is that part of the process as important as the actual communication of ideas to others, or is it a case of...
That's a good question, because I think I could, probably am naturally a closet writer, and it took many years to have the confidence to even let others know that I am writing, and to share it with others. That felt quite terrifying, but I've realised the importance of doing that, you know. And that's been a slow process, but now I think I understand the importance of sharing those ideas, and now I very much welcome feedback from other people. I think it's it hones your writing skills, but I think it's also very much, I love that sharing of ideas, and I think that's another reason why I like working in groups. You know, when I facilitate, I never think I'm teaching anything. It's more a question of gathering a group of people together who have stories to write, and I'm very interested in people's life stories, people who want to write maybe a memoir, which might be a part of their life, not necessarily their whole life. I'm very interested in facilitating that, so that people can express what it is they need to about their story, and have it shared with others and get feedback. And I find the sparking of each person's stories, including my own, is quite magical and a wonderful thing.
Because I think I first met you when at one of your memoir writing courses at UWA Extension. And so how long have you been teaching memoir writing?
Oh, that's a good question, Iris. I began at UWA Extension in 2005, so that's quite a while ago. And I ran... at first, I think it was Rachel Robertson and myself. I had this idea, and she said, "Oh, you must do this at, for example, UW Extension." So I needed someone else to give me the confidence to do this. And then after a while, I did it by myself. So it was that one and a fiction course as well, which was called Writing for Freedom and Fun, which was just fun writing and sharing and play. I love wordplay as well. So that was 2005, and I stayed with UWA Extension for a long time. And then since then, I've continued to run different versions of a life writing course, sort of developing it still, now more often with Centre for Stories in Northbridge.
Right, okay. Yeah. And I think one of the things that you did to have some continuity was that some of the people who'd been involved in the memoir course then came into a group that you ran. So to continue with that process, I guess, of being able to do
that. That's right, Iris, because it was a 5-week course. Now they're 6 weeks at Centre for Stories, but regardless, obviously people always feel, oh, well, now we've got some basic skills, because it's often people who wouldn't consider themselves writers. Sometimes there are really good writers already, who are just looking for some sort of structure. But people always say, oh, well, now that we know each other very intimately, and that we're embarked on writing our stories, we need to keep going. And so because of that, I started a group where people could come. It began in Fremantle in High Street, just above Bodkin's Bootery, and we'd meet once a fortnight, and people could come there informally, that they didn't have to commit every single fortnight, although a lot did. They'd just come when they could, and I'd give a prompt which would mean that they could miss a few. It didn't matter. They could still keep writing and, you know, get... And one man, actually, Ken, he came to UWA in those early days, and then he came to the ongoing group, and it took till about a couple of years ago, by which time he had written his whole life story, just coming on Tuesday fortnights.
So it just kept him ticking over.
He didn't do anything outside of the club, right. Well, you know. But and it was gripping, because he was not a writer at all, but in the end he actually became quite a good writer.
Yes.
And he had been a pilot, an air pilot, and he had had so many adventures throughout his life, and it was a wonderful, you know, story. Wow. The whole thing. And yeah, so that was great.
Yeah. Yeah. And you continue to teach creative writing and different forms of writing and also... host the free fall writing group that occurs as well. I wonder if you can just talk a little bit about your current projects in that respect.
Yes, that's a good point, Iris. The free fall, when I was introduced to Barbara Turner Vesalago, a Canadian author who runs a free fall. She calls it Freefall, and there are various influences, including Peter Elbow and various people. But her method resonated with me, and I went on one of her UWA extension courses before I began teaching myself, actually. And I loved that Freefall method, which I had already been doing. I think a lot of us just discovered this, which is where you actually do begin with. Usually it's concrete detail, often sensory detail, and then you just keep writing without editing yourself or crossing out. You just keep the pen moving, not necessarily writing fast, but just keep moving forwards, even though you think, oh no, that's the wrong word, just keep going. And she was very encouraging to me and helped me out of the closet, I suppose. And the method I teach is not the same, but there are resonances. And when I teach now, I began teaching at Curtin University in about 2013, I think. And that was after completing a master's degree there in creative writing. And I was asked to teach, you know, and I was terrified, but thoroughly enjoyed it. I began with teaching short fiction. And since then, I teach a number of different units, including long fiction, where people are writing novels or novellas, and also that's as part of the creative writing department. And then there's also the professional writing, where I teach creative non-fiction and feature writing, and different other units at different times. But I love them both, and I found that actually, bringing that same basic method of stay with the senses, keep it real, stay in the body, be concrete, and keep the pen moving. A lot of students of all ages, they're mostly younger there, have really helped, they found that very helpful to be unstuck, you know, to help yourself not just suffer from the blank page.
Yes, yeah, which is the curse of all that.
That's right. Yeah. So it seems to work for all genres.
That's right, exactly. So you've also been involved in the publishing industry, and I'm probably going off script a little bit here, but so that's fascinating, what we've talked about before, off the recording, but I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about that, and that was quite a long time ago.
Yes, it was actually, that's right. So again, Iris, I found that I've always, I suppose, just followed my natural inclinations, instincts and things I love, and so I ended up studying languages. So I studied Romance languages, French, Spanish, with some Italian at Aberystwyth University. I mean, where else would you go apart from Wales to study French and Spanish and Italian? I did spend some time at a French university and a Spanish university. But then, of course, I realised, and anybody could have told me this, that once you have a degree in languages, well, there's nothing much you can do with it, really. You know, you need extra training. So when I went to see the careers officer, they were, I mean, it reflects the attitude of the times. Some man who said, oh, well, if you want to speak languages and travel, you might as well go to Spain and become a bus driver. And I thought, well, not really. But I did realise I needed to do something else. So I did a postgraduate commercial course, which involved secretariat and so forth, because that was the pathway then. This would have been when I graduated, 1974. Mm. And in those days, for a lot of women to be able to get into whatever area it was that they wanted to go into, unless you were trying to be a lawyer or a teacher or something, you needed to come at it often through that secretarial route. Mm-hmm. So I did that, and then once I'd done got that training, I thought, well, now what do I launch into? And so I decided I'd try doing temporary work, sign up with the temp agency. Mm-hmm. And I tried all sorts of things, like in London I think I worked for Warner Brothers and thought, well, this is quite interesting.
Wow.
But it wasn't until I worked for what I thought was a publishing company, but it actually turned out to be a literary agent. And this was a little attic in a building in London somewhere with piles of books on the floor, mostly women actually, and desks popped at odd angles, like a little warehouse. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, I love this. I love the atmosphere. I love all the books. Mm-hmm. I love the content of the letters that they're writing to authors and publishers, and I thought, this is what I want to do. So then I applied for jobs at first with a publishing company, an international publishing company called Western Publishing Inc. in London, so an American company really. Mostly they did little golden books, you probably remember those.
Yes.
And a stack of other things. So I worked there for a little while, and then after that, still in London, I got a job with A.P. Watt & Son, which was a literary agent, and I just bumbled in there quite innocently. It was advertised. I got the job to be an assistant to, it was Mr. Horniman. There were two gentlemen who ran A.P. Watt & Son. And I didn't realise, but that was the most famous literary agents there was in London, and very well established, and very eccentric. Indeed. Mm. So he himself, Mr. Horniman, looked like Jules Verne. He had a great big beard,
right,
and an Oxford accent. And in fact, the first time that I came in to take dictation, here's a beer right there.
Okay.
And I kind of couldn't understand anything he said. So when he'd got to the end of the letter, you think you're sincere, I said, I'm terribly sorry, Mr. Horniman, but I didn't get a word that you said. Because he also wandered over to the filing cabinets, pulled them out, buried his head in the filing cabinets while he was dictating as well. And he said, ew. So then I said, oh, he said, oh, right. So he repeated, thank you for your letter. But we actually got on very well, and yes, quickly I came on board. So it was a very eccentric place, but I really loved the contact with the actual authors, yes, a whole range of different types of authors, some writing Mills and Boone's bodice rippers, yes, who turned out to be, two of them, elderly, one a 90-year-old woman and her son, who is in his 70s, and they needed to keep getting their work published because they needed to pay for their medication. And I spent many hours on the phone with them, just talking to them. It was really, I think that was my chief role, was to talk to the authors and be sympathetic and oh yeah. And we would, of course, then reissue a lot of these books, get onto the publishers and so forth. But it was mainly the therapy of them getting things off their chest. Yes. And another woman that I got very fond of was the Times correspondent, the wine correspondent for the Times, mm, and Pamela Van Dyck Price. And she needed to just phone up and have a good talk and say how much she missed her husband, who taught her everything she knew about wine, and you know, and she produced books on wine, and we would review them. And I think just mainly to play that role of intermediary for them to know, because when they would phone, Mr. Horniman would go, no, I'm busy, and then my role would be to just talk to them, and I actually like doing that.
So, which is why you got the job. Able to be flexible and do everything.
So just really interested in the books that were produced. We had a lot of dead authors who were people like Somerset Maugham and Rudyard Kipling, so we were managing those estates and often reissuing their titles and so forth.
Right.
And I think I mentioned to you before that it was in the days before computers. And so that nowadays, if you wanted to look up a detail like, oh, when was this Somerset Maugham story first published, you'd just probably Google it, or you could easily find that. But in those days, there was no such thing. So I would have to go to it was a cupboard at the end of the corridor where a man seemed to live, Mr. Conley, who would wear a dress shirt and trousers and big boots, and he was terribly shy. I suspect he might have been a bit autistic.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd ask him a question like, oh, Mr. Conde, I want to know when this story by Somerset Maugham was first published. And he would know. He knew everything that was in all the files that surrounded him on the shelves. He would say, oh, yes, I think you'll find that would be, and he'd come out with this month, day, year.
Well, he was the computer.
And he'd say, I'll just check that for you. And he'd know, his finger would go along all the files, and he'd go straight to the correct file, pull it out, flick through, and he'd go, yes, that's right. And it was correct. So he was a walking, living computer.
Excellent.
And, it was just such an extraordinary place that, modern technology is wonderful, but really you can't replace how it used to be.
That just goes to show how much the publishing industry has changed over the years. And have you kept abreast of how... what's happening in the publishing industry?
Yes, up to a point. I have, in a sense, Iris. One thing that strikes me in particular was that in those days it was very male-dominated.
Mm-hmm.
So Mr. Conde, the computer man, was a man, and the two people who ran the show, they were men. There were women coming along, though. It was a time of change then. And there was one young woman who was the foreign rights manager, Maggie Noack, and she now has her own literary agency in London, and she manages crime novels and that sort of thing. So you could see there were a few other women too who, like me, beginning either in secretarial, that kind of thing, personal assistant, and gradually finding their way, and they've since developed careers. And now when I look at the literary agents, they're quite dominated by women. There are men too, but it's a very, I think that and publishing is a much more female-dominated domain now, and that, of course, influences the type of thing that are being published.
The types of stories. And,
yeah, that's right.
Different kinds of social influences that impact on what gets published. And
yes, I think that's absolutely right, because Mr. Horniman was very sympathetic that people would send enormous physical manuscripts in brown paper parcels, and he would dutifully at night in his little flat. His family lived on the south coast, but he would come up in the week and he would read through these manuscripts and really seriously consider them. But of course, it's always a tricky thing, isn't it? Going with what is selling, what the market is, and that has shifted. And I think the influence of women have definitely, in the industry, have made a change. But, I was only talking to a colleague and friend yesterday, Rachel Robertson, about how still most of the literary agents and publishers, they are in the south of England. They tend to be in the London area. And I've written a novel, for example, based around the area I grew up in, which is in the English Midlands, where there's a whole different culture and dialect and different way of being, really, as I found out when I worked down south, that the industry was dominated by the women that were there debutantes, And when I spoke to Rach Robertson yesterday, she was also working in London in the later 70s. And she said, likewise, she worked for Chatto and Windus and a few others. And those more traditional publishers like A.P. Watt and Son, it was debutantes who were working there. So we were discussing the fact that even today, this lack of diversity, geographically, culturally, really, is reflecting in what's being accepted for publication, because I think I'll find it quite hard to get my novel published. And, you know, feedback I have had is, oh, yes, it, you know, it's very nice and all, we're quite interested, but I can't help feeling that the dialect, there's a bit of dialect in there, and that different sort of culture, people... Unless you come from those sort of areas in Britain, it's hard for them to, you know, think that who's going to want to read this. Well, I actually think anyone north of Watford, lot of people actually would like to read this.
Well, that's part of the problem of the it's always going to be, I guess, a subjective call, and people do the best they can to work out what's interesting and what's going to sell and that sort of thing. But that's a interesting thing. But what about Australian publishers? Have you had much to do with?
I haven't had a great deal. Well, I mean, I've got some had something published like you have too with Fremantle Press, and I find I like to support those smaller publishers who wouldn't survive without funding as well. Often. Yes. So I don't know so much about the Australian publishing industry, but I think things have changed quite a bit. Like in the 80s, it seemed quite easy to get things published in Australia and anywhere else, whereas it's pretty tough now, I think, to get things published. But I think one thing that's really changed, of course, is because of the internet, and then there are lots of other ways to get published, and that's not a bad thing. You know, there are many interesting online publishers and websites and ways to put your work out there. You know, even some people like to do blogs, and they have their own personal.
Unfortunately, we lost the end of this recording, but I found the talk so interesting to this point that it seemed a shame not to share it with the listeners of this podcast. Thank you so much, Rosemary, for agreeing to be part of this. And again, thank you for listening.